And good afternoon. Welcome to We the People. So if I take a really deep breath and talk really slow, Bill will be in his chair. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
We are
Billy and Patrick.
Yes, our special guests today.
Classic. Is it going to be like that? Are we going to be like that today?
I see it coming.
We're talking about dire topics, so, you know, of course. So let's see. Bob's calling our guests. So, well, is Bruce on there yet?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. All right, so you might as well give them both a holler, and while we're doing that, we'll tell you a little bit about them. We've had both of them on before, and I neglected to put those links on the page for today. You can find everything about the show except for the previous shows with Claire and Bruce, because I haven't posted it yet, but you can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. So it has our phone numbers, email addresses. We'd be happy to hear from you if you have ideas for sponsorship, other stations that might want to play the show, or, you know, ideas that you have on show topics or guests or things. So we do a lot of response to the folks that listen, and so we're happy to hear from you. So our guests today are chatting about, I don't know, I just put jihad hits the U.S. shores yet again, and I didn't have a better name for it, but both these guys are involved with national security. Bruce is a senior national security advisor who focuses on strategic planning for national security issues. He's a consultant that works with public officials, U.S. government committees, departments, agencies, think tanks, corporations, that sort of thing. And he is with Security Solutions Technologies, which is a veteran-owned company. We had Chuck Floyd on last week. He's the CEO of that company. Did a bang-up job on the scandal with the Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives, who have shall we say, trafficked with the Owen brothers, hired them for their IT consulting services,
show.
Which is just
great show.
Crazy. So, of course, we resorted to a tremendous amount of mocking, and so it was a pretty fun show last week, actually. I think you'll like it, and very informative, and hot topic, current.
Mm-hmm.
That's been brewing since February, so that is not done. Big investigation pending, and so if you're not aware of that one, I would suggest you listen to the archive from last week. And then Claire Lopez will be joining us, or maybe already has. And Claire is a strategic policy and intelligence expert with focus on national defense, Islam, Iran, counterterrorism. Currently a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy and vice president of the Intelligence Summit. And she formerly was a career operations officer with the CIA, professor at the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies. And she has a whiz-bang resume, which we have posted for you.
Whiz bang.
Can't go wrong with whiz bang.
Capital whiz.
Can't go wrong with whiz bang, huh?
No.
It's not enough. You know, I like to use the words that have kind of fallen into disuse. I feel sad for them that they're in the dustbin of history. So, all right, we have both these guys on here. We're not totally sure where they're taking us, but Bill and I are not experts on counterterrorism or anything like that.
So I've been terrorized, but I, you know.
There you go.
Yeah.
So we'll be, we tried to go to the park downtown yesterday. Yeah. Wow. Things have deteriorated there. Anyway, we'll leave that for another day on local topics. But Bruce and Claire, where would you like to go, and who wants to go first?
Well, hello, this is Claire, and the first thing that I need to do is send you a new resume. I think you must have pulled an old one off of the Internet.
It's the same one I use every time.
I have actually now been senior... I was a senior fellow for the Center for Security Policy for 4 years, from 2010 till 2014. But since 2014, I am the vice president for research and analysis there at the center.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. And we had you just as kind of a flunky.
Well,
I don't know what senior fellows do, but it sounded good. But vice president's much better. please shoot me a current list, because it really kind of goes on from there. It's very... it's very comprehensive, so I'm sure some of those things are still true, but yes, hate
we'll put it on ZipRecruiter if you like.
ZipRecruiter.
No, I'm very happy where I am. I get to work with Frank Gaffney and the whole team at the Center for Security Policy. Couldn't be in a better place.
No kidding, and you guys are at the forefront of all this stuff that just keeps happening over and over and over. So I know you're only on with us the first hour, so I don't know how you guys have this divvied up, but I'm assuming you're doing the lion's share here the first hour, Claire.
And then,
well, I am waiting for your questions.
And then we have Bruce hostage the second half, so he's got a whole bunch of stuff for us the second half.
Sure, we can talk about the New York City Halloween terror attack, and then we can go from there. Because Sarah's, that's area that's been in the news, but it's not really been fully addressed in a way that Claire and I would look at it in a different manner. So, Claire, if you want to lead off, or I can lead off, you know,
I'm waiting for your questions.
Well, I was kind of curious on that Halloween deal. I guess they're saying he was a domestic recruit. Did he have actual contact with ISIS?
Well, what I would say, first of all, is there is no ISIS.
There you go.
ISIS stands for Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham, and that name went away 3.5 years ago.
Oh, okay.
From June of 2014 until now, it has been the Islamic State. We could shorten it to IS if you'd like, but Islamic State. And no, we don't know of any contacts in a direct way between the shooter. I'm thinking of the church in Texas.
Right.
Between the Halloween.
The van driver.
Truck driver who rammed and killed all those people. Any direct contact between him and the Islamic State. We don't have that. Although the Islamic State posted something like he is a soldier of the Islamic State online. But, of course, they've taken credit for things they didn't do before, so hard to know.
Interesting. So what do you think the deal is with that? And why are
he's a jihadi. There's no question about that. He's a devout, practicing Muslim jihadi. His first name is Saif Alo, which is a form of Saif Allah, meaning the sword of Allah. So he obviously comes from a very devout, practicing Muslim family that would have named their son such a thing. And he kept the name into adulthood, came into the United States with it, so got to wonder who did that interview.
That was my next question.
Yelled Extreme Allahu vetting. Akbar when he got out of the vehicle after it had crashed into a school bus.
But so isn't it Jake Tapper who thinks that's a beautiful phrase there?
I would like to ask Jake Tapper when he and how did he study Islam?
Kidding.
Absolutely.
He needs to get out more.
So this...
Yeah, he's also from, Tampa, New Jersey, so there's a lot of work that needs to be done to find out who his contacts were, who he knew, to what degree he knew it, and... to do a little bit better background before they let people from Uzbekistan in, because that's just north there.
It does seem like this fellow bounced around quite a bit. He always seemed to be employed as a driver, a truck driver or commercial, truck driver or an Uber driver. He is supposed to have lived in states including Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Missouri, Maryland, and was carrying a New Jersey driver's license. Now, the thing that they need to look at first is which mosques did he attend, because that's where you're going to find the locus of the jihad that he was part of.
Well, they already know where he attended, don't they? I mean, weren't they watching the mosques that he attended?
New York City police had a program that they call the Demographics Unit, which monitored area mosques extending into New Jersey, where his mosque is called Masjid Omar, or the Omar Mosque in Paterson, New Jersey. And that was one of the ones under monitoring by the NYPD until the likes of Linda Sarsour and Muslim Brotherhood figures pressured the NYPD into shutting down that program. And then the monitoring of that mosque and many others ended. I'll add something as well here. We also know that when he was in Ohio, previously, like about 5 years ago, 2012 is the time frame there, he was in Ohio, and there he attended a mosque called the Islamic Society of Akron and Kent, located in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. And we know for a fact from just looking at their online website that that's a Muslim Brotherhood mosque. The bylaws, for example, of that mosque are posted right at its own website. And in the bylaws, it says that in case of dissolution of the organization of the mosque, that the assets should go to ISNA or NAIT. ISNA, Islamic Society of North America, or NAIT, N-A-I-T, North American Islamic Trust. Both of them, unindicted co-conspirators named by the Justice Department in the Holy Land Foundation Hamas terror funding trial. Investigation is done. This guy is Brotherhood.
Absolutely. So what's the chances of him being tried as or handled as an enemy combatant? Is that even in the cards, or is he going to be tried like a regular U.S. citizen?
And which is better?
It looks like he's going to go through regular civilian court. I don't know why we put enemy combatants through a court system in any case. The United States court system is for Americans under American law, under the Constitution, and the laws derived from it. That's Article 6 of the Constitution. He is an enemy combatant. He should be sent immediately to Gitmo. No trial, nothing, just locked up until the cessation of hostilities in the current jihad war, and whenever that may come or not come.
So that's mostly forever.
Well, then he stays at Gitmo forever until the end of his natural life. But it does look like they're going to probably, for expediency's sake, try him in a U.S. civilian court.
Do you think this will instigate any change in the NYPD policy on these mosques? I mean, everybody knows what's going on there. I know the mayor doesn't want any bad relations, but this is out of hand. I mean, they've got to do something.
Well, one of the things I wanted to contribute here, and I think it's important, is once you put them through our system right away, then you don't continue on with an investigation of aiding and abetting.
Ew.
And that's what Claire and I are talking about, the different areas that he visited or had contacts before he actually, he surveilled New York City, Manhattan for 3 days before he went through for 17 blocks. It's not known generally that he took a drive for 17 blocks through people, and then he, jumped out, and then they shot him a couple times in the stomach. But my point is probably the same as Claire's. We got to find out where people are aiding and abetting. If he's been traveling these different places and getting information on how to exact a terrorist crime, then we got to, stop it at its source. And we have to take the trail backwards, not, have him in court right away and then prosecute him.
Right.
Yeah, that's my take on it. But
they're kind of acting like, they kind of act like these people just pop out of nowhere and there's only one of them. And when we come back, we have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, I'd like you guys to talk about the network that supports these folks.
Exactly.
Because that's really, I'm not even going to say downplayed, that's just ignored in the whole system. And that truly is the trick to stop some of this. So anyway, we'd like to hear your thoughts on that. You are listening to We the People. We will be back with Claire Lopez and Bruce Moran
in just a couple of minutes. We're going to do a little celebration of capitalism here. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Come on, people, now smile on your brother.
That's the program they've got going on in New York right now that's not working out so well.
I think they had the marathon today, so I hope they didn't have any incident. I mean, that was one of the big deals. They did cut out some of the programs from the marathon, but they did run the major part of the marathon. So,
They've had most of the drama appears to have been in San Antonio today. But okay, so talk to us from, I don't know if you guys both look at this the same way. I'm not sure, where you're area of focuses, but what about this networking
business, you know?
Well, it's very live and active. They work in the black market, the underground economy, and the formal sector. We operate in the formal sector, so they're very active. They know how to usurp and circumvent our system. And that's what Claire and I both talk about in different ways, but we do the same thing. I mean, we're trying to get a handle on what they're doing, and, you know, we were looking at his activities, and I would like to know myself what happened right before he came to the United States, who he's involved with, what he did, you know, what kind of action he was performing. You know, then he gets into the United States, and then he's all around the country, like Claire was saying. So there's something not normal there that, you know, its head is sticking up. And if we're allowing these kind of people in, what are they doing, where are they going, how are they doing it? That's what we want to know.
Well,
the network is the network of Muslims. We have to face this reality.
Right.
This individual, Saifullah Saipov is his full name, grew up, as we obviously can tell, in a devout Muslim family in Uzbekistan, where, by the way, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan has long been a serious terrorism threat, both there in Central Asia and in other places where the fighters have gone, like Afghanistan. And then he comes to this country with a name like Sword of Allah. Did anyone ask him about that name? Did anyone ask him, what does that mean? Why do you keep it? What is its significance for you? Did anyone ask him that? Probably not, because they have no bloody clue. So the family is the first circle of influence for Muslims growing up. And then from there, they are probably going to go to madrasa, that is an Islamic school. They likely will be attending a mosque here or there or some other places. We know that this individual, Saipov, attended at least two. We know the names of at least two, the Masjid Omar in Paterson, New Jersey, and, of course, the Islamic Center of Akron and Kent in Ohio, probably attended mosques in other places where he lived. So the next place you look for influence is the mosque, the imam, the other members of the congregation. No Muslim lives alone. A Muslim is part of a community. It begins with a family. It expands into the mosque, the Islamic Center, family, friends, and so forth. In every one of these centers, there will be Islamic influence. The first thing the child learns is at his mother's knee. After that, in school. I can show you online at Amazon.com the textbooks in English that are used in American madrasas, U.S. Islamic schools all over the country. And they are taught, children are taught jihad and sharia from the first grade. This is not just some sort of osmosis procedure. Muslims are part of a community. They learn. They're not radicalized. That is crazy. There's no such thing as radicalization. They are raised in the faith. They are raised to be devout, practicing Muslims. For some it takes. For some it doesn't take. Same as with anybody. But in this Saipov's case, it obviously took.
And devout, practicing Muslim means getting rid of people who aren't devout practicing.
So how does that explain the moderate Muslims that don't believe in jihad and
that tell us that they don't believe?
Yeah,
that,
well, the jihad is part of all the teachings. You have the Sufis who
obligatory for every Muslim
to jihad in a spiritual way.
Jihad.
But then you have we call them certain Shi'i and Sunnis who practice it in a more of a war fashion. So, and if that's inbred in your teaching since you're a kid, and if you say you were with ISIS in Iraq and Syria, and you got a passport, because the ISIS had control of Iraq, a passport making, and you became a refugee, and your mother and you came to the United States or to Europe, then they are already here. We know they're here in every state, but I mean, they are here, and they're taught at a young age that people outside their community are apostates and infidels, meaning if you're a Muslim and you are not practicing what they're practicing, you're an apostate. If you're other thing than a Muslim, you're an infidel. So those two factors there separate them from the rest of the Muslim community. And they could be practicing with moderates or, you know, extremists or other, you know, people who just come, you know, occasionally to the mosque. But the important factor here is what Claire is saying is the jihad. Jihad is an accepted term. It has many meanings, but more so than we can say today, there are, you know, 1,000 or more terrorist activities happening a year in, around the world. And that's not because it's not, you know, a jihad. It is a jihad. And people aren't realizing that.
Well, there is actually only one definition of jihad in Islamic law, and I will quote directly from the book of law that is called the Umdat al-Salik, and that is, jihad is warfare against the non-Muslim. It is warfare to spread the religion. That is the definition of jihad under Islamic law.
It's pretty straightforward.
It is also the definition most common throughout the Quran. It is certainly the definition most common throughout the life of Muhammad in the Sirah, that is his biography, and understood by the scholars.
The practice, you say.
The mujtahid.
Yeah, it is the practice.
Historical time and currently. So there's really no such thing as a moderate Muslim. There are people who don't practice their faith faithfully. There are people who would be called lax or disobedient or fallen away. But the very word Muslim itself, the word itself in Arabic means one who submits to Allah and to Sharia. That is the definition of the word Muslim. So its own word carries its own definition. Either submit to Sharia, which demands and obligates every single Muslim to jihad, or not, in which case, you know, many people live their own lives, they get busy with jobs and families and children and all of that. Natural, normal, okay, fine, but you can't call them faithful or practicing.
So it's like a Christian. I'm a Christian, but the whole Jesus thing is really, I don't.
It's kind of a burden.
Yeah, it's kind of a burden.
Well, tell me this: if we know what they're teaching in the mosques, because we have a question in the chat room here, and she had asked, how do we know what's being taught in the mosques? We know then what's being taught in the schools to the kids because the books are available online in English, as you pointed out. So how do we know what they're teaching in the mosque? And let's say we absolutely knew because somebody, you know, from law enforcement went to the mosque and these guys are like, all right, we're going to, you know, take these guys out. They're making all these plans. Why is it, do we always have to wait until they do something?
I mean, this has been the way.
I mean, this is the balance.
Civilization, certainly across Western Europe.
Right.
And the New York Police Department, which was at one point in time the premier counterterrorism police force in this country, like I said, got taken down by the Brotherhood and basically kneecapped in its ability to monitor mosques and what goes on inside of them, to put confidential informants inside, to have people reporting out from inside what is taught, what is the literature, what are the DVDs available, that sort of thing. But I will point out the example of France, which is, as we all know, under all-out assault by the forces of the Islamic movement, and so many horrific attacks having taken place across France in the last couple of years. But just recently, a new counterterrorism law went into effect in France, and that law empowers local law enforcement authorities to enter mosques, to penetrate mosques, to monitor mosques, and even to close down mosques that they find to be a terrorist jihad threat. So do we have to wait for a Nice, France, a Bataclan, a priest beheaded at the altar? I hope not. But
so we can't, currently under our laws, we cannot infiltrate or close down a mosque if we know that terrorist activity is being planned there. We have to just wait for them to come out with gun in hand.
There are restraints on local law enforcement, including now the NYPD, about monitoring. I mean, to find anything out, you've got to monitor in the first place. And because their ability to monitor has been taken away They're not able to find out what's going on inside, and only by luck, a whistleblower, some informant, somebody gives them a tip, something may tip them off about something being planned, but they cannot proactively monitor the places where we know. I mean, mosques are not Muslim churches. They are command and control centers for jihad.
Exactly.
Why? Because that's how Muhammad established them. That is what they have been from the beginning. The first mosque, of course, established in Medina after the Hijra in 622 from Mecca. So until that authority is returned back to local law enforcement to be able aggressively and proactively to monitor what's going on, not just the spoken sermon or the khutbah on Friday prayers, but the literature that is in the Associated Bookstore, the DVDs, or even what people are talking about. Unless they're able to do that, we're going to find ourselves in the position of Western Europe and France.
Would now that they have this this guy in custody, they know what mosque he attended, is that not enough to start surveillance on them, or they need more than that now?
Need a higher body count?
One would hope, but we don't know. I don't know where law enforcement is going on the Saipov investigation. One would hope that they're investigating the mosques where he attended, but who knows? Maybe they're too afraid of being called an Islamophobe or a bigot or a racist.
Well, those guys, when they capture these guys, are they forthcoming with information, or are they pretty tight-lipped? They don't they stick to their guns?
Well, we know in the case of Saipov that he was talking in his hospital room. He was shot, but is going to survive. It's not life-threatening, and he was able to talk. And not only did he ask for an Islamic State flag, which, by the way, is simply the black flag of Islam. That's all it is, the black flag of jihad. But he apparently was talking to the law enforcement that he was proud of what he had done. Well, of course he's proud.
Right.
He's a jihadi. He did what he was commanded to do. But other than that, we don't know where the investigation has gone or if it has moved to look at the mosques he attended.
God, if that doesn't make him an enemy combatant, I don't know what does.
I'm kind of curious. We have to take a quick break again, but I'm kind of curious when we come back, is it better that they die or is it better that they live? And I realize that's sort of a bad and mean-spirited question, but I guess as far as solving the problem, is it better that we put him in prison or is it better that we just eradicate them as we go? And I'd be curious you guys' thoughts on that when we come back. So, you're listening to We the People Radio, kind of a big topic today. Hope you're enjoying it. You can find everything you need to find about the show and archives and stuff at wethepeopleradio.us.
My mother, there's too many of you to cry. Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see, sister, oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Side in the shotgun sings the song. I tip my hat to the new constitution. Take a bow for
song just took on a whole different meaning. All right, so Claire or Bruce, whoever has thoughts on this, is it better if they live? I didn't even forget during the break, actually, my question, which I typically do, and I, like, launch off on something else.
So you're referring to martyrism.
But I seriously want to know, is it better for us? Not better for them, obviously, or their families and stuff. But
I mean, incarceration cost us $32,000, $28,000 a year. But the most important thing about keeping them alive is to find out who they were with, what they did, you know, how what their habits are. That is tells you a world of difference about getting information and extracting it from them.
Is it?
I think the living part for an act like this is yes. For criminal activity, that's a mass killer. No, you know, they're two different, separate, and distinct things. Terrorism has a whole different tinge to it, especially if it's jihad. Because like I was saying earlier, jihad and terrorism around the world, there's over 1,000 incidents a year. People aren't realizing that. And it hasn't come home to roost here in a way where people are. I think there's so much violence going on and so much activity where you're seeing a lot of protests that people are not really taking to account what Claire says. I understood this years ago, and Claire understood it from the get-go because she was in the field. But people who don't know what we know don't understand that keeping somebody alive is a better way to find out what's going on and how you're going to get some information from them. I'll defer to Claire now. So,
no, I absolutely agree with that. In cases like these, what you always want to do is to interrogate the attacker. And
I didn't use those words, Claire.
Find out.
I know, but that's what we actually have to do. And there's a lot of pushback on interrogating people, and that's why they want to put them put them in jail in the United States, so they don't interrogate them. And that's what ticks me off personally.
So
because I know they need to be fully interrogated in a lot of different ways. So.
Sure, but okay. So Claire, with your background. Okay, so let's say we get to quasi-interrogate them, because I know that's very unpopular. But their platform that they would get in a U.S. court, not a Guantanamo situation, but in regular court, the platform that they have at that point to spread their message or whatever you want to call it, the notoriety that they get, does that hurt us?
That helps them do what they need to do to hide. You put them in Gitmo.
Hold on,
they're there. Oh, let me talk for like 30 seconds.
Okay.
They're there by themselves, isolated, and they got to think about that. And then they start talking, and then you start the interrogation process, and then they start talking a little bit more. Then you increase your interrogation methods. So the idea of them being in a general public in a jail, in American prison, where they can socialize or, you know, they have three squares that way, is different than Gitmo. That's what I'm trying to convey.
Sure.
Now, Claire, it's off to you.
Well, no, I was just saying that the actual trial process is not something that really is going to boost their status much more than it already is. You know, it depends on what kind of statements they're permitted to make that are quoted in public, of course. But honestly, what we've seen with jihadis captured and brought to trial, not just here in the United States, but elsewhere, Canada and Western Europe and other places, is that when these individuals actually are allowed to speak, they tend to speak truth. And that's not a bad thing. They speak truth. I fought for Allah. I did this for Allah. I am fighting fi sabil Allah. I am a jihadi in the way of Allah. If that's repeated often enough, maybe, just maybe, it'll begin to sink in.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a good idea. That's an interesting
But just saying
look at
that,
it.
I mean, that makes them a combatant. Why doesn't that, you know, make a mistrial and send them to Gitmo right then? I mean, that's end of the story.
I concur. I agree with the president, too, on his immediate assessment. We just have a whole system of people who are pushing back against us and understanding, you know, there's a different way for them to handle would kid gloves, this kind of murderous, treacherous, I'm going to say fanatic, homicidal activity. You know, and that's really bad. And my own group, we call it homicidal fanatics and Islamic jihadists. And I'm going to, you know, be very truthful here. They are homicidal, they're fanatics, and they don't care. You can see what happened in New York. You see what happened in Orlando, San Bernardino. That's the way it goes down, but nobody's taking it as on face. You know, that's the way it is. But, you know, we don't want that to happen. Claire understands the fact, bottom line, I do, but it's not the way it's being reported in the news, and they soften everything up.
So the Center for Security Policy, Claire, do you guys have the ability, I mean, who do you work with primarily? Do you work with law enforcement, government? I know you guys do all sorts of different things, but...
Well, when requested, for example, we will provide briefings to members of Congress. I participate, along with John Guandolo, at Understanding the Threat and his team, in training and teaching law enforcement across the country. We've been doing that for a couple of years. So we do a lot of that, plus, of course, different kinds of broadcasting, TV, radio. Thank you very much for the platform.
Always.
We do a lot of writing, reporting and issuing of papers and reports and that sort of thing. So it's across a whole spectrum of educational activities. As a 501c3, that's our primary responsibility, is education, and we do that in all of those ways.
Are we getting somewhere with that? Do you feel, I mean, we've got like...
Not at the federal level. At the federal level, the war is lost already. The federal level is in the hands of the enemy, and I really mean that. But at the local level, and that is, of course, where an insurgency actually is fought and won or lost, at the local level, we think that we have a better chance of fighting back. The problem is that the bad guys, the Islamic movement, has a long head start. They came to this country. The Muslim Brotherhood came to this country shortly after World War II. That's how long they've been at it. We are only beginning to glom on, but I will say that at the local level, when we do talk to sheriff's deputies, police departments, and just local civilian patriotic groups and individuals, they get it. And I've seen a real learning curve take place at the local level over the last, I'd say, 5 to 6 years that I've been, you know, speaking around the country. So we're encouraged at the local level, but, boy, have we got a long way to go.
When you say the federal level, are we talking about all of the law enforcement? We're talking,
yes.
You know, FBI,
I mean,
and all these guys?
I mean, the Department of Defense.
We need
the Department
of Justice, we need to
the Department
have,
of Homeland Security.
The
I mean,
Senate
the intelligence community,
approve
I mean,
people
the White House,
at mid-level
I mean, the National
to start
Security
executing
Council,
and enforcing what we know
hold on, Bruce.
The Muslim
needs to be done.
Okay, wait. Claire, say that one more time, because you guys are both on the... Sorry, there.
Okay.
What I was saying is that at the federal level, the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, the Department of State, the intelligence community, the White House and the National Security Council have all been suborned and are not working to counter the Muslim Brotherhood enemy. We know for a fact that inside of the FBI there is not one single individual, not one single unit that is dedicated to going after the Muslim Brotherhood as a subversive enemy of the United States of America.
So you
not
say
one.
Suborned. What do you mean by
that?
For
what reason? I mean, how?
That is how influence operations work. That's how it works. They got inside a long time ago. The Brotherhood got inside. The Islamic movement got inside a long time ago. They provided briefings. They said, we will teach you about Islam. We'll tell you what it is. Those guys, those awful Al-Qaeda guys and Islamic State guys and Taliban, you know, they're extremists. They're you know, that's not us. We'll explain to you.
Yeah.
And so they had the inside track.
Oh, so they got a seat at the table, basically.
Which is deceit and dissimulation. And to spread an untrue understanding of Islam within the federal bureaucracy, the federal government. And so what happened during the years, especially of 2011 till 2012, although it began much earlier, is what we call the Great Purge. And literally, PowerPoints, presentations, syllabuses, you name it, and the instructors that went with them, if they taught accurate truth about Islam and the role of Islamic doctrine as inspiration for Islamic terrorism, it was removed from the federal government, and the very words jihad, sharia, caliphate were removed from the lexicon. I mean physically removed.
Oh, yeah.
No one in the federal government is allowed to speak or use or train these words and this understanding since that time.
And
that is what I call suborned.
Well, we also had a military purge.
These government agencies,
and that happened with about 170 generals and admirals who were, I would consider, patriotic, who were trying to keep certain of the idea in place to be, you know, a patriot and follow and protect the country, but they were removed also. So those are 175 generals and admirals. So it happened, the purge was happening in so many different sectors, you know. Claire, it's all, you got the table.
Claire, where does Jeff Sessions stand on this? Does he have any ability to, you know, move forward and get rid of these people that are influencing on the federal side to not go after this?
Oh, he has a lot of ability, plenty of authority. Where he stands, I just don't know. I can't tell you. We don't see any evidence at the federal level, Department of Justice, or any other place since the Trump administration took office this past January of a commitment to countering the jihad, to going after the Muslim Brotherhood, to identify the Islamic movement and to formulate and execute an effective policy to defeat it. None. Zero.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's some of it's happening on a smaller scale, but we're not getting our appointments in at the mid-level at DHS and all the different departments and agencies.
So we're left with all the Obama guys.
Yeah, of course. So there's pushback. I don't want to go into detail what I know, but I'll talk about what Claire's talking about, and she's absolutely right. I mean, there are people there. There are not many of them, but they're, you know, underground because they can't really come forward and enforce the law like they know they need to do. And if they step forward, then they get squashed, you know, and that's a shame. You know, they've tended to, like Claire was saying, change the whole dynamics of how law enforcement's been educated, what they can say, what they cannot say. So you don't even have freedom of speech. And if you say something wrong, then they call you on the rug and you can get demoted. So even if you look at Gregory Hicks, you know, we were looking at Benghazi when we were working on that. He got sidelined and he testified, but that was the end of him. So even people want that step forward and say things about what they think is true and what they believe. He's the second in command in Tripoli, by the way. Then you just get squashed. And that's how big the bureaucracy is. And if they can, you know, sideline and eliminate, say, 170 or more, 75 generals and admirals, there was a big purge going on and at the CIA and the National Security Council and at the FBI and all the different things. If you just got to be on board and you follow it and you get your pay and you get your promotions, and that's what they do. There's no understanding of patriotism, you know, going out there and doing your job and enforcing it to protect all citizens. Citizens aren't being protected to the full extent of the law. There's no enforcement. I'll turn it over to Claire. So.
What about
I'm saying too many strong things because we're dealing with this stuff right now. So.
Yeah, what about our Secretary of State? I mean, isn't that where it kind of all starts?
Well, the Secretary of State certainly has a very responsible position within the cabinet, within the president's administration and team. Unfortunately, what we're seeing from Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is a failure to understand the Islamic movement, to understand the jihad that we are facing, not just at home, but rather internationally as well. A failure as well to understand at a strategic level what's going on in the Middle East, for example, which is more his portfolio at the State Department, international affairs rather than domestic ones. And there we see that there's very little understanding at the State Department of For example, the expanding influence, aggressively expanding geostrategic influence of Iran and the Shiite Crescent. The land bridge that's been built across from Tehran through the Middle East, cutting across to find its outlet in Lebanon on the Mediterranean. Just today we find out that the Prime Minister, Saad Hariri, of Lebanon has resigned and fetched up in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to make the announcement because otherwise he was afraid he was going to be killed back home in Lebanon. Nobody's paying attention to the expansion of Iran. It's encirclement action around the Arabian Peninsula. Think how this goes. Mentally, think of a map. Beirut, Lebanon, on up to Baghdad, to Baghdad, Iraq, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Iranian Shiite the Shiite regime. Damascus, of course, is a Tehran puppet. And now all the way around to Yemen, where Houthi rebels are receiving assistance from the Iranians, and a missile, a ballistic missile, was just intercepted, luckily, over Riyadh, the capital, and pieces of that missile fell apart, broken, onto the international airport in Riyadh. This is what's going on in the Middle East, and I don't see any indication that Secretary of State Tillerson understands that at all.
Wow,
Never mind. One last point, the strategic waterways that are being incorporated under Iranian, at least threat, if not control. First of all, Strait of Hormuz, of course, at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, and then, of course, the Bab el-Mandeb, which is the narrow strait that runs between Yemen and the Horn of Africa. Extremely important waterway right there with access to the Red Sea and on up to the Suez Canal.
Holy cow.
These things are coming under threat by Iran and a Shiite crescent surrounding the Arabian Peninsula. I never, ever heard Secretary of State Rex Tillerson say a word of what I just told you.
Wow. I'd love to talk more about that. We got a hard break coming up. Claire, thank you.
If you can stay with us, Claire, we'd appreciate it. If you can't, we totally understand. Thanks for being there. And Bruce Moran is sticking with us the second hour for sure. He's our hostage. Claire's an optional hostage.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate being with you.
I gave the floor to Claire.
Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Claire, for standing up and being counted. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. All right, we'll continue on. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.